Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Abba Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
Hey there, welcome to Addicted to Faith, the Last Storyteller Podcast. I am Jim Hurdle, and I'm your host. And today, I'm going to take a little turn off of the grandma tree. The last couple episodes, you've been coming with me as I wrote that short story, The Grandma Tree. And I wanted to take just a pause for today. Don't let your hearts be troubled. The grandma tree is still in progress, and we will definitely bring it back. But just recently, a very good friend of mine, she lost her battle with cancer after quite some time. Her name is Annette. I've known her for many, many years, and she's a good friend. And she was actually probably my most avid reader. At least that's what she told me she was. I would give her advanced copies, and I don't do that as a matter of course. And she would bring them back to me with her red pen all over them, and she enjoyed doing that. Annette, a few months ago, decided to no longer go through the treatments that she was receiving. Sometimes for the cancer patient, the treatment is worse than the cancer. And she had reached that point. And she's gone home just recently. And I will miss her greatly. I remember how it felt. I went through chemo treatment. It's been 9 or 10 years ago now. And I was battling stage 3 colon cancer at the time. And I do remember that feeling. I'm sometimes coming home after the treatment and just wanting to stop everything, you know, because it makes you feel so bad, whether it's nauseous or the mouth sores, the neuropathy, just being tired all the time. And you felt like you were really fighting a losing battle. But through the grace and mercy of God, I'm here all these years later and cancer-free. So this story is called Michael's Chair, and I wrote it while I was going through chemo. And so, Annette, this one's for you. Michael's Chair by Jay Hurdle. The first time I saw him, I knew it was more than cancer gnawing at his soul. His name was Michael. I was in a room where chemotherapy is delivered 6 days a week. A dozen chairs, a dozen people, patients, or victims, hairless ghouls. Each morning, a different group arrives to the cancer center. Different faces, different cancers, different stories. It's on Mondays that I make the trip to the cancer center to have the profitable pestilence delivered through a port in my pest, in my chest. That was just too many peas. The profitable pestilence delivered through a port in my chest. And these toxins entered my veins, and they began another skirmish with the cancer that was living inside my colon. On the Monday I saw him, it was my fifth treatment. For Michael, it was his first time there. I had the pre-meds already on board, and they were traveling along the vessel byways, and I had settled into my chair when Michael plopped down into one across from me. He was wearing an old pair of dirty blue jeans, a green sleeveless shirt with a faded logo for Mountain Dew. The words, "Do the Dew," had faded, now professing only to "Oh, the ooh." That was strangely appropriate. He wore black work boots that had seen better days. The steel toe protector was peeking through the worn leather. He bared tattoos on both of his arms. His right arm, more conservative with the ink, had a braided rope wrapped around his wrist. A word was entwined within the rope, but from my position, I couldn't make out what that word was. On his left arm, he wore a magnificent full-sleeve tattoo, afloat with brilliant colors. I don't have any tattoos. My 57-year-old arms have stubbornly shied away from the artist's ink. I hold nothing against those who wish to have their bodies transformed into a living canvas. I admire great art, and what Michael wore on his arm was beyond great. It was a masterpiece. From my vantage point, I could not see the entire protoplasmic canvas, but visible, beginning at his bony shoulder, was a Herculean tiger bearing razor-sharp teeth. The tiger's eyes are luminous gold, so realistic they looked as if they could be plucked right off of his arm. Behind the tiger, serving as the background canvas, flames of orange and yellow, outlined heavily in charcoal black. This apocalyptic image was the background for the three images on his arm. Below the roaring tiger, a rose in full bloom. The artist had combined a dazzling red with the same orange and yellow he had used as the backdrop. The result was a rose on fire. And yet, like Moses' burning bush, no harm befell the rose. The traveling tattoo ends just an inch above his scrawny wrist. The last image was a wise owl, adorned in colors like no bird who ever flew through the night on this side of reality. The artist's love for orange and yellow and red, adding a tinge of charcoal gray, were blended to create a color that I have no name for. I can only describe it as majestic. The talons on this nightbird are not perched as what you would expect upon a twig, but instead they grasped a stogie, a cigar. The bird presents a tender, loving grasp on the cigar. The cigar's ring is amber-colored, and it bears the letter M, inked to resemble diamonds on a wedding ring. You know, I would often query Michael about his tattoos. I wanted to know the stories they told. Michael always laughed at my inquiry, saying, "I will one day, when we have more time." We never did. Michael ran out of time. Now, it was not my habit to engage in conversations with other patients when I was experiencing the delights of chemotherapy. It's not that I wanted to be left alone in my misery. I enjoy good conversation. Most of the patients in the Monday group, well, they're older, you see. And sometimes the older are more likely to share the details of their miseries, vivid details, with anyone who would listen. I believe my daughter calls this TMI. Now, please don't color me without empathy or compassion, for I truly possess both. But to compound my own misery with someone else's misery, well, that just didn't seem to fit. Michael is a talker. Within minutes of sitting down, he looks across the aisle to where I'm sitting. And I was reading an e-book on my tablet. I was doing my best not to stare at him or his tattoos. And he asked me, "What are you playing, man?" I look up from the tablet. A hint of West Texas is in his words. He spoke as if he was in a hurry to go somewhere or seeking an answer. "I'm not playing," I told him. "I'm reading." "Cool," he replies. He glances around the room, intense eyes staring, exploring as he shifted in his chair. He has the jerky gyrations of someone who is hooked on crack. But I spy the tremors of withdrawal as he moved around and exploring everything, exploring the surroundings. I wondered, is he somewhere between being stoned and being sober? He appears anxious, a trait rarely exhibited in this room, where the denizens urge the passing of time to slow down. Once the bags are empty and the needles are removed from the pin-cushioned arms, Follow-up appointments are scheduled. We return to a world where nauseousness awaits us as we lay and watch for death to knock on the door. That's why we want things to slow down. Michael was not slow, but surveying the room seemed to have silenced his tongue. As the day progressed, he loosened the ties, and Michael didn't stop talking. He spotted one of the three nurses working in the room. He raised his right hand as if he was in grade school, and he waves. An indistinguishable tattoo on his right arm that I hadn't seen. Nothing to be really considered, but clearly noticeable were the track marks running down his arm, the harbinger of abuse. The tracks formed a T. In the crook of his arm, three red circles surrounded by some bruising, forming the cross of the T. Traveling down his arm and through the crook were five or six smaller circles. The bruising around those was darker, maroon in appearance. I thought they had to be older. Each mark, just as his tattoos, would have a story to tell. Michael looks across the aisle. "You wondering about these?" He points to the track marks. My face turns red.
"Oh, it's okay, man, it's okay. I don't try to hide them. I used to, you know, but not anymore. I sort of hope they never go away. You know what I mean, man? They remind me of where I came from."
His words, as strange as what they were, eased my embarrassment. I shifted in my chair, searching for the right words to respond with.
"Hey, it's cool, man," he tells me. "You don't gotta talk."
He smiles. His teeth reveal what I'd suspected. They bore the decay of a crack addict. Sometimes there's a little voice that whispers inside of us. Sometimes I believe that voice belongs to God. Other times it comes from something we call our conscious or inner voice, a feeling. I can't tell you where that little voice originated from on that day, but I can tell you what I heard. "Talk to him." "I'm sorry for staring," I began. "Where did you come from and where are you going?"
"I came from a dark place, man. A dark, dark place."
He looks at my snakeskin boots.
"Someone like you probably wouldn't want to hear about it."
He was wrong. He continued.
"Where am I going? I'm going to heaven, man."
He laughs. This man who wore tattoos and needle scars on both arms sat up straight in his chair and he asked me,
"Hey, man, do you know Jesus?"
"Well, for almost 30 years, I replied.
"Wow! Dude, that's awesome! That's awesome, dude!"
What about you, I ask. "How long have you known Jesus?" My question was not just in response to his. I was curious about the fresh track marks on the arms of a believer.
"Oh, man, you know, I've known him for like one day, man. Yesterday, man, yesterday, I walked into a church for the very first time since I was like a little kid being dragged there by my old lady."
Over the next 3.5 hours, I learned, before he walked into a church and surrendered his life to Jesus, he had gone to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting at the emphatic urging of his sister. She had been clean for more than 3 years. She believed and told Michael that the only way out was to look up. After the NA meeting, they had breakfast at the IHOP a few blocks away from his sister's church. Buying her brother a meal would provide her the opportunity she'd been waiting for. She leveraged it to urge him to finish what he had begun that morning at an NA meeting. Come to church with her. Michael confessed to me that he didn't really want to go. He thought religion was a fancy building filled with every Sunday with people who are hypocrites. Hypocrites who look down on people like him. He may be right. He told me as they walked to the church, all he wanted to do was to bolt.
I kept looking behind me for a way out, you know. But sis, she kept walking and talking, telling me not a single person in church had ever looked down upon her. And I was going, you know, maybe she's right. She goes, I was the same as you, Michael. She told me she was the same as me. I didn't know that, you know. I didn't know that about my sister. But anyway, she kept bugging me, and I kept following her. And she told me that all the people there, that they stood by her during the darkest hours of her life, man. During the darkest. That, man, can you believe that? She told me that they were there when she had backslid, you know, backsliding. That's, you know what that is, right? And sometimes we go backwards instead of going forwards. And she had backslid a couple of times. And she had returned into that murky area of her own addiction. And she told me they had been there for her, man. They'd been here when she hit rock bottom for the second time. When she told me all that, man, dude, I couldn't do anything but follow her. So I just kept following her. Did you finally hit rock bottom? I asked him. Oh, no, man, no, no. People think you got to hit rock bottom before you can stop using, stop abusing. But they're wrong, man, they're wrong. You see, that's BS. BS, bullshit. It's BS excuse to not stop using. You see, if they haven't felt the sharp edges of the stones, they think they're okay. They think they don't have to stop sucking down narco or snorting Cracker Jack. They got time before smashing into the ground, you know, man. It's BS, dude, man. It's just BS. His agitation was unsettling. Michael continued, I ain't lying to you, man. Listen, I could see the bottom. I could touch the rocks with my toes, man. I could smell death rising up. But you know what? I never hit the bottom, and I never will now. He smiles again. Michael's words hold a raw intelligence I wouldn't have thought was possible with an addict. The drugs he abused had destroyed brain cells without concern for him, for the proprietor of those cells. Destruction leads to a weakened system that can no longer say no to the drugs. But here he was, talking to me about Jesus. I never hit bottom, man. I never will now. Our conversations that day and the following week included stories of his addiction. We also talked about sports and cars and music. I wanted to hear the tales of his tattoos. I had questions, so many questions. Michael, well, he had questions too. His were about God, his understanding of scripture, of religion, and of God was innocent. It was elementary in the beginning stages. He often would change subjects in midstream to ask me a question about God or about heaven or about Jesus. Michael talked. I listened. He questioned. I answered. At the end, I was the one who learned. The following week, Michael was sitting in a chair and hooked up to the IV bag when I arrived. A young woman was sitting in a chair next to him. She was dressed casually, wearing a light yellow sundress. She was pretty, with long golden blonde hair. Her complexion speaks of someone who spends a lot of time outside, but she looked very tired. Her name is Chelsea. She's Michael's sister. Michael smiled when he saw me walking down the path between the chemo chairs. The seat across from him was already occupied by another patient, so I took the chair next to him. He introduced me to Chelsea, his voice carrying the same fatigue I saw on his sister's face. The siblings, they looked exhausted. The nurse arrives to prep me for my next treatment. Michael and his sister sat silently, watching the nurse move with ease, her task performed too many times. It only takes a minute to get the chemo engine running, and then the nurse pats me on the head and turns, heading off to her next patient. I look over at Michael and I asked him how he was doing. Not good. We sat silently for a long time. At last, Michael and Chelsea speak, taking turns, telling me about the last chapter of their story. Michael was going through withdrawals, years of abuse, refusing to leave quietly. Chelsea had spent most of the night trying to find a rehab center that would accept Michael.
but there was no money, no insurance. Mike hadn't held a steady job in more than 2 years. I learned he lived by stealing and by cutting the drugs he purchased and then reselling them as pure. More than once, the buyer had returned to beat Michael for selling what Michael called shit. Or, out of the revenge emanating from their own lack of euphoria coming from cut drugs. 3 months ago, Michael moved into a weekly rent apartment building after landing a job as a dishwasher at a local honky-tonk. The apartment building had once been the home of hard-working citizens raising babies between shifts, watching rented movies on a VHS player, people who paid their rent on time. After years of neglect and decay, the building and the neighborhood changed demographics. Most were now poor, jobless, and one step away from being homeless. Most of them abusing the same drugs as Michael. A united community. The truth was, your neighbor would kill you just as quickly as they'd share a joint with you. Michael had provided a glimpse into the dark place he'd come from, stopping short of supplying all the details. Now I knew more. I asked him if he had spoken to his oncologist about getting some help with the withdrawals. He said they told him they were working on it. Chelsea changes subjects, a lot like her brother does. Michael told me you helped him with some scriptures he was struggling with. I really appreciate that. He doesn't like to talk to me about God. Michael interrupts her. No, that's the way it used to be, sis. You brought me to your church, man, even when you knew I didn't want to go there, and you brought me there. I talk to you about God, baby sister. I talk to you. Anybody about God. I'll talk to anybody about God. But, you know, I just don't know how to get there. You know, how to start talking to somebody about God things. Talking to you guys is easy. You guys both know God better than I know him. But telling someone I've never seen before, telling them about God, telling them how much he loves me and how much I love him, you know, that's kind of hard. Most people can't. Chelsea smiles, taking her brother's hand. For the next 2 hours, we talked about God things, taking wide paths around the subject of withdrawals, rehab, chemo, and the uncertain future Michael is facing. He had many questions about walking in new shoes and where this new path would take him. Chelsea impressed me with her knowledge of the Bible. Her love for Jesus was on display with every answer that she gave to her brother. Every question that Michael asked, her response was just love. Our conversations took an unexpected turn. Suddenly, we were talking about Michael's past again. Michael had made this turn. You know, I thought I saw an angel once. I was so freaking high, and this angel was there, man. And then she began to change, dude. I mean, you know, like a transformer. I thought I was seeing God's face. God's face is scaring me, man. I mean, bad scare, like no scare ever before. It's most I'd ever been scared in my whole damn life, man. I thought God was going to kill me right there in the alley. He glances over at his sister. He was going to kill me because I was, you know, I was stealing all the time and I was getting annihilated all the time, man. I was ate up really bad, really bad. God's face was right there in front of me. I could have reached out. I'm sorry, dude, man. But I could have reached out and I could have touched it, Jimmy. I could have touched his face right there. But I was afraid, man, if I did, my hand would freaking burn off, man. You know, I was bent really bad, you know, and you think things like that. But somewhere inside my head, somewhere up here, man, I heard a voice. It was telling me, this ain't real, man. You're just screwed up right now. This ain't real. But it didn't help because I kept being scared. Man, seeing God's face like that is fucking freaky, man. I was crying like a little baby, rolling up in snot.
And then I started to scream, man. I was screaming. I squeezed my eyes shut and screaming. I was trying to scream that face of God away. And when I opened my eyes, man, guess what? That face was gone. And Trapper Jack was there, man. Trapper Jack, he was standing so close I could feel his hot breath on my cheeks. It smelled like butterscotch. I looked up into him. I looked into them dark eyes, man. And I knew he was coked up pretty bad. And he was pissed. He was pissed at me, you see, because, man, I owed him money. I owed him money for some of the pop he sold me. I had been hiding from him, man. I didn't have no money to give him. I blew the profits on buying more pop to shoot up in my veins, man. I couldn't help it, you know, man. I needed to be high, Jimmy. I needed to be high. I needed to go numb. He stops talking, shaking his head. Man, Trapper Jack, he took a step back, man. And I was just laying there, and then I see his foot, man, and it's heading right for my man parts, man. Bam, man! He kicks me hard, man, over and over. He just kept pounding and pounding me. And I knew, man, I was going to die right there in the alley. This was it. I was going to die. And then, the same as when I saw God's face, I knew I was going to die. And I was crying, and I was choking on my snot, man. It was all the same. And then suddenly, the kicking stops, man. And I opened my eyes and Trapper was gone. And then three of his boys came out of the shadows, man. And they picked up where Trapper left off. I was counting the hits, man. You know why? You know why I was counting them? So I wouldn't feel them, man. I thought if I count them, I won't feel them. But that didn't work, man. And then I guess I blacked out. And when I woke up, I was in the county hospital, man. And that was cool, you know. Because county hospital, well, they got drugs. I sat looking at Michael. I didn't know what to say. Chelsea was crying. Michael finished his treatment that day before I did. They stayed until the chair Michael sat in was needed by another patient. He got up and headed to the restroom, leaving Chelsea there alone with me. She told me she was worried about Michael, that the withdrawals he was suffering from were really severe. She said, the days, he's better in the days. But the nights, if he keeps busy, she said, the pains are a lot less. And at night, she said, it's really bad. She said, Jimmy, I think he might try to hurt himself. She asked me if I'd give her my phone number. You know, in case I don't know what to do when he's at his worst. I don't hesitate to give her my cell phone. Adding that so she could call me anytime, Chelsea, day or night. We said a quick prayer together, asking God to take control of Michael's life. Michael came back and sat down for just a moment, and then we said our goodbyes. I had no way of knowing that it would be the last time I would see this tattooed, drug addict, born-again Christian named Michael. Day 28. I hate chemo day. I just started feeling better after the miserable side effects from last week's treatment. And now I know before the end of this day, feeling better will be just nothing but a faded memory. But today my usual dread is replaced by anticipation. I look forward to talking with Michael to hear how he's progressing in his recovery, how he's dealing with chemo. Chelsea hadn't called all week. I was really wanting to sit and see how he was coming along. The waiting room was full when I arrived at the Freeman Cancer Center. I checked in and find one empty seat. I sit waiting to hear my name called. First will be the weekly blood draw, followed by a weigh-in and a conversation with the doctor. After the brief and incessant interview, I'll enter the treatment area to begin another agonizing journey. I looked around the waiting room to see if Michael had arrived yet, but there were no signs of him or his sister. I launched my weekly habit of discreetly looking at the people in the room. I perfected the art of observation without appearing to be observing. And I sit there and I look at them and I make up their stories. I make up what kind of cancer they're battling. You know, most of these folks are older than me. They have scurried past the average lifespan many years ago. And I wonder sometimes if I would have their courage if my own cancer had been delayed, arriving 20 years from now. I wondered how long the desperation to keep living lingers in us.
Chemotherapy is appalling and humbling experience. The We Care people try to motivate and convince you that it won't be as bad as what you've heard. You see, lying is part of their job duty. I do remember my first treatment, meeting the nurse who would administer the chemo treatment. She belongs to the We Care Club, but she was different. Her name was Rosie. Rosie was from New York. I've grown to admire her. I will forever remember her words regarding my treatment. She leaned close to me and she said, "This is going to suck, but you'll be okay. It's my job to make sure you are." Ah, Rosie, what a woman. At a few minutes before 9, they call my name. At that same moment, my cell phone vibrates. I didn't recognize the number on the screen. I almost tapped the ignore button, but I didn't. I wish I had. "Hello? Hi, can you talk?" It was Chelsea. The nurse was standing in the doorway waiting for me. I asked Chelsea if I could call her back in a few minutes. I explained that I was entering into the torture chamber. She didn't reply right away, but she finally agrees, and I can hear the disappointment in her voice. And then she was gone. The few minutes turned into 30 minutes before I could return Chelsea's call. The doctor had dominated most of that time with good and not so good news. Later, his not so good news would pale in comparison to the rest of my day. After settling into the chair, I pull out my phone. The nurse pokes my port to begin the 5-hour drip. I hit the callback button. Chelsea answers after the first ring. "I'm sorry it took so long, Chelsea, to call you back. The center is just really busy today. What's up?"
It's Michael."
"What's the matter, Chelsea? Is Michael okay?" A long pause. Her breathing is unsteady.
Michael's dead."
Her crying seeps through the phone. I can almost taste her tears. I let her cry, listening, waiting for her agony to ease. I thought it might never stop.
"He's dead," she repeats. "I don't know what to do."
An image unfolds in my mind of Chelsea and Michael. Is she with him now? Is he lying dead on the floor next to her? The image develops slowly like an old Polaroid picture. Michael lying on the floor, his blood soaking into a torn and ragged carpet, his head beaten in by some thug named Trapper John or Trapper Jack. Chelsea sitting on the floor, her legs folded beneath her in a praying position, cradling her brother's bloodied head in her hands, the yellow dress drinking in the blood that the carpet ignored. The image was grossly skewed, but Michael was dead. "Chelsea, I'm so sorry. What happened?" I asked, trying to conceal the tremble in my own voice.
28 days. It was 28 days ago. Michael changed his life. You know, all he spoke about yesterday was reaching day 30. His NA meetings, they recognize milestones. And day 30 days, it's not a long time. Unless you're an addict in recovery, and then it's a lifetime.
And she began to sob again. I could only listen and wait.
Yesterday there was an eviction notice on his door. He was 60 days behind in his rent. He never told me. It was only $300, and he didn't tell me. I could have found the money, but he didn't tell me. I would have helped. But he wouldn't let me. Early this morning, the police were knocking on my door. I saw them through the side window, and I knew something was wrong. I knew it was Michael. I thought he must have fallen off the wagon and got busted or done something stupid. I wish he'd done something stupid. The police told me the property owner had come to evict Michael. The constable was with him. When Michael didn't answer, But Michael didn't answer the door. I can hear the tears tracking down her cheeks. When he didn't open the door, they opened the door, and Michael was lying on the floor. He was lying on the floor, and he had a syringe sticking out of his arm. He had overdosed. Michael was dead. I'm so sorry, Chelsea. I didn't bother to try and hide my own emotions this time. There was a note. A suicide. A night is bad. I think he might hurt himself. I didn't want to ask. But I did. Chelsea, what did the note say?
Just two words on the top. He wrote, "I can't."
I wait.
Jimmy, there was more.
More?
And it was for you.
I look up at the IV. Liquid drops falling one by one. She reads from his note.
"Hey, Brother Jim, I never told you everything, man. You know, I believe that night in the alley, I believe it was an angel who saved me. I believe she chased away the bad guys before they could kill me. Sometimes, man, I wish that angel had never come, Jim. I wish it had never come."
Chelsea pauses, and then he wrote,
"Hey, will I still get to go home?"
"Will he?"
Chelsea asked.
Hot tears burn my cheeks. Bitterness swabs my lips. I cry silently in a room filled with people who are desperate to live. She waited. I cried. That little inner voice whispers, the Lord infusing me with his promises. I look across the aisle at the only empty chair in the room. Michael's chair. Chelsea, Jesus said, "And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish." She finishes, "Neither shall man pluck them out of my hand." That's right, Chelsea. He's holding your brother's hand. Michael, he'll never fall again.
"My brother's dead, Jim. And I don't understand. He was trying. He was doing so much better."
Chelsea, listen. 28 days was not long for you or for Michael. It was a brief moment. But for God, 28 days was all the time he needed to call Michael out of a bad life and to turn him around. And for 28 days, a lifetime of abuse was gone. You see, God, that's God. Only God can do that. He had plans for Michael, Chelsea, plans you or I will never know or never understand. But God knows. We make bad choices and wrong decisions. I think even when our decision is to die, God knows. Even when Michael's decision was to die, and God still called him.
Michael liked you, Jimmy. So do I. I just need to call you and tell you what happened, and to thank you.
The call disconnects. I never saw Chelsea again. You know, I don't even know her last name. Michael's dead. 28 days. I closed my eyes and dreamt of tigers with golden eyes, owls with mighty talons, and roses set on fire. Well, thank you for listening to Michael's Chair. I'll be back. I hope you will too.